Hey folks, this is the Guru here. I'm coming at you left to right from your radio dial. I just wanted to let you know what you guys are listening to is a collaboration podcast. So in the past, the guys have recorded a lot of podcasts with other people on their podcast platforms, and we are repurposing those podcasts for you. So let us know if you like it. Even if you don't like it, let us know. And be sure to go onto iTunes or whatever podcast platform you're listening to and give us a 5-star review. It really helps us out on the ratings and everything. And that is it. Have a great day.
Welcome to the Born and Raised audio experience, presented by Onyx.
Are you an adventurer looking to take your hunt to the next level? Then you're in the right place. Welcome to East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic.
Hey everyone, we're back. So I have another exciting episode coming up here today, and this episode is with Born and Raised Outdoors. So I was lucky enough to get Trent Fisher and Cody Kellum to both join me on the podcast here for a phone conversation, and I was really, really happy that they agreed to come on the podcast here. These guys are ones that I've looked up to personally for quite a few years now. One, from the elk hunting standpoint, and two, from their journey with Born and Raised. And if you followed along with the podcast up to this point, you'll pick up on how I'm big on, chasing your dreams and really following whatever, you're passionate about. And these guys are the epitome of that. They've figured it out and they're learning through this process and just putting out some amazing content. So really excited to have them on here and for everyone to get to listen to it. So with that being said, I just wanted to give a couple more updates here. Just got back from the ATA show in Indianapolis. It was a great show. Got to hang out there for a while, see some old friends, meet some new ones. A lot of new gear coming out, and as we had in the last few podcasts, the 2019 Sika gear, really exciting, and has a little bit of a personal thing for me since I was, able to field test some of this new Fanatic gear and everything and get to put it through the ringer. It's, some really awesome cold weather whitetail gear, so excited for that. A lot of other items that were a buzz this year. I don't get too excited about, new products, but it was really cool to see some of it and a few things that I might add to the arsenal this year. Also, doing a giveaway. So kind of teamed up here with Onyx Hunt to give away 2 elite memberships, 2 app cards that covers all the states. And $99 value, this app card. So I'm giving it out in 2 different ways here. There's one way is to, if you purchase any apparel from the website here through January 2019, just making sure I put that out in case someone's listening to this at a later date. So anytime here in January you order any apparel, you're automatically entered to win. And I'll announce that early in February. The other way is if you head over to our Instagram and Facebook page. So on Instagram, that's East Meets West Hunt. And on Facebook, it's East Meets West Outdoors. And there's a post there that has a picture of myself, my brother, Michael Mason, sitting there. And you'll see the logo and the Onyx logo on there. Read that post. Check out the details on how to enter there and have a chance at winning one of these Onyx 1-year memberships to the elite memberships. So be announcing all that early in February. Got some shows coming up. I'll be work in the Maven Optics booth at the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg. I've been working that booth for Maven now for 3 years, so really excited to get back to Harrisburg, the biggest outdoor show in the country. So I'll be there for I'll be there on both of the weekends, so the first week of February and into the second weekend there, doing a little bit of podcasting, but mostly, you know, working the booth there, talking about Maven, and, you know, come check them out. And after that, heading out to Michigan for a speaking event at a wild game dinner. And I have some information on that over on the Instagram page as well. And just definitely check that out. And if you're in the southern Michigan area, I think there's still some tickets available, so come check it out. It's going to be a really good dinner there, and I'm lucky enough to be able to talk a little bit about planning, you know, do-it-yourself Western hunting, and they're going to have some of my apparel there and some more Onyx cards to give out there at the show, or at the dinner, excuse me. So check that out. Got some busy stuff going on, and then really leading right into some really intense scouting for Pennsylvania mountain whitetails, as well as some Pennsylvania elk shed hunting. So there's a lot of stuff coming up here. Busy time through here through the winter. Excited to keep going on with that. Another thing that I wanted to talk about real quick is I started a new workout program. So I've always been one that's to prepare for, you know, going out west. I love working out. It's just been a part of me. I like the healthy lifestyle, and I really truly think that it does help out in the mountains, and you can do it without working out. Don't get me wrong, but it definitely creates a less miserable experience from that side of things if you're in better shape. So I'm going through the Mountain Tough Fitness. They've come out with, they had their preseason workout plan, which was like a 3-month program last year that they came out with and launched, and it was extremely successful. Well, this year they launched a postseason one to help build you up, build some muscle back on you. So that's a 4-month program, and that leads right into the 4-month preseason workout. So that leads you right into basically into September. So I'd definitely recommend checking it out. I just went through 2 weeks of it so far, and it's definitely kicked my ass. But I'm really excited to see how this turns out. It's built for the hunter, and really hitting some things that I hadn't covered, you know, in my own workouts. But more importantly, it just keeps you accountable, and it's easy to, you know, for me, I work out before work, so it's easy for me to try to, you know, hit that snooze button when my alarm goes off at 4:30. But this really holds me accountable to go in there and do it and track all of that. So we'll have some more updates down along the line on how that program's going. But so far, it seems pretty awesome. Excited to keep going along with that. So, with that being said, let's roll right into the podcast here with Trent and Cody. All right, welcome back to another episode of the East Meets West Hunt Podcast. And today I'm joined on the line by Trent Fisher and Cody Kellum of Born and Raised Outdoors. What's going on, gentlemen?
Not too much, man. We're just here in the beautiful town of Roseburg. A little bit rainy outside right now. It's been a whirlwind. Let's just say that.
Living the dream, absolutely.
That's right.
Awesome. Are you guys settling down a little bit from finishing up the Land of the Free 2.0?
Oh yeah. Yeah, no, this year we're trying to turn and burn on that. So we just put out 2.0 and just got finished with it Christmas Eve or something like that, and then we're trying to get as much content out as we can now, so there's not going to be any lull like there was last year a little bit after our project. So no, we're still doing a lot, full steam ahead,
man. Yeah, we just finished up. We had the wrap party for 2.0, did a live podcast, and had a bunch of people out, and actually had all the collaborators there, Hush, Pure Elevation, Angry Mountain, the Bugler, Dirk, and it was Go Hunt Guys. It was really fun to get everyone back together again, one final hurrah before show season and everything else gets going. So
yeah, I just got the notification on my phone as I was waiting for you guys to get on about the podcast release in there, as far as the live one that you guys did. So I'll have to check that one out for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun times. Lots of laughs and storytelling and a little bit more of behind the scenes than what just went on the YouTube channel. So.
Oh, cool. Cool. Well, yeah. So today, first off, if you guys kind of want to, you know, briefly introduce yourself here and just kind of talk about a little bit who you are and why I guess I'm talking to you here.
Yeah, I mean, so we started Born and Raised in 2007 in kind of the same scenario, chasing a dream. No one had really filmed the Roosevelt side of life. And, you know, what we saw on the hunting, you know, outdoor channels wasn't what we felt hunting was. So we decided to pick up a camera. We never even turned it on till opening day of archery season 2007. And we just kind of went for it and made some DVDs, did a TV show on Sportsman's Channel. Had a film tour, full draw film tour, ran that for quite a few years. And then, we heard about this thing called YouTube and, we thought that was a place for funny cat videos. That's kind of how, you know, our looks of it. And it really actually Casey from Hush was the one that really kind of opened our eyes to that, Casey and BMAC both. And so we started putting all of our content digitally on YouTube. And last year was kind of like the big breakthrough for us. November 1st, we launched a project. It was like the first day by day. We did a 50 days, hunted 5 states for archery elk all across the West, and did it again here this year, 2.0. And yeah, it's been a whirlwind, to say the least, in the last about 18 months. But we've been truly blessed and humbled by it and met some amazing people, got to see some crazy scenes and beautiful country and all chasing elk in September. So,
yeah, I actually, it's funny because when I was first kind of introduced to you guys, it was probably maybe 3 years ago now that you had a film in the Badlands Film Festival. Was that
okay?
Was that
right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I was at the ATA show and that was the first Badlands Film Festival I ever went to. And I remember watching that video of you guys. And I had heard about your DVDs, but never, and up till that point, I think that was my first year hunting elk. So before that, I wasn't really exposed to a lot of elk hunting media. And I just remember that epic shot there at the end, the frontal while he was bugling. I think that's the video if I remember right, but.
That was a fun video, and that was the first time we'd ever entered into really a contest at all. So it was a super big blessing to come out of there and be the winners of the whole thing. That was pretty awesome.
When I saw that, I was like, who are these guys? I got to check them out. And at that point, I don't think you were on YouTube at all yet.
We had one video basically at that point. And so we kind of had an idea leading up to that. And actually that year was a year that was kind of turned for us, really, because that was the shift when we had this idea land at the free. And so then we started publishing on YouTube that summer. So
okay. So kind of explain to me, if you would, about why did you start Land of the Free? And I know you briefly discussed, you said, you know, you went 50 days of elk hunting, but kind of give a little background on why you started that.
Well, it comes down to we're gonna hunt elk hunt anyway, as many days as we can, obviously. And so we tried to kind of set out for doing something nobody'd ever done before. And that was like just to show what day by day of elk hunting would be. And then we chucked in, well, let's do that and do it in a bunch of different states so people can see the difference in the states and the journey that we would go through that. And it just morphed into something greater than us. It morphed into something huge as far as the character following and following just the whole the whole project as a whole, and especially for us, because we went into this thing not knowing, we had no idea, we had no expectations, we didn't know if it was even going to happen. You know, we just threw some dates on paper and said, hey, let's call these people, these other influencers, and see if they'll go with us. And it was a huge blessing when every single one of them said, yeah, we're all in. And then we thought, oh man, now we have to do this. So we did it all and made it through the whole thing. And then the big thing of the Land of the Free was, for us, it was showing people that anybody can do this. Anybody that just has the drive and the notion to get out there and experience something great can do this. And I think that's hopefully what we tried to show in that whole thing is people that think that coming out west or going anywhere, because this was a big thing for us too. I mean, we were inside our bubble here in Oregon for a long time, and we'd only hunted locally for a long time until we finally just got outside our bubble and said, hey, we got to try this out of state thing. And that was a big venture for us. And I can't imagine, like, from your viewers and a lot of people back east where you live, it's a huge undertaking to come out west and to just say, yeah, I'm just going to go here and I'm going to just start hiking. You know, I mean, that's got to be very intimidating. And so, yeah, we tried to break down those barriers with this YouTube series and tried to show people, hey, we're new. We haven't done this before either, but we're going to try it just to kind of maybe help, you know, help other people out.
Yeah. And it's funny. And one of the big reasons that I wanted to have, you know, both of you here on the podcast is I'm coming from, you know, the complete opposite side of the United States that you're at, come from Pennsylvania. And that was kind of like my big, I guess, I don't know, breakthrough, where when I first went out west, and it was more or less coming down to just doing it. And I was really late to the game. I wasn't really, you know, into, I guess, taking in a lot of media and stuff like that in the past. And all of a sudden I discovered Cameron Haynes and Donnie Vincent. And I read Cam's book about, you know, backcountry bow hunting. And I'm like, I want to do that. And just kind of put it on a calendar and got my brother and, you know, my cousin, and just went out to Colorado and backpacked for 7 days and hunted elk. And that was just such a game changer for me, that's kind of when, like, you know, the vision for the podcast that I'm doing here and everything came about, and just showing people that it's not as big of an undertaking as you can kind of make it out to be in your own head. And it seems like you guys especially are big on, you know, just do it.
No, and I think that's a lesson that you learned early on, is people do make it out to be more than what it is. And so they put these barriers in front of them, and they, you know, they live in this small comfort zone in the box, and they're unwilling to, like, break down those barriers. But then once you do the first time, and all of a sudden life's fuller, you know, more experience, then you go do it again. And then, you know, next thing you know, you'll be doing an Alaska trip or whatever else, like things that you just would have never dreamed of, just from those, you know, breaking down those barriers and having those life lessons and experiences. So,
yeah. And so when was the first time that you guys hunted out of state?
So that was Wyoming
2012.
12?
Yep.
Yeah. So we said, hey, we want to try to do this. Let's try to go hunt Rocky Mountain, because a lot of us hadn't ever hunted Rocky Mountain elk. We just stuck to the Roosevelt thing around home quite a bit. And so we ventured out through a dart on a map and said, we're going here. And we were fortunate enough to get some tags. Went out, and honestly, it was one of the, probably looking back at it adventure wise, it was one of the best adventures that we've ever undertaken. Yeah. Before, just because it was so new, and we realized that these Rocky Mountain elk, they, you know, you could go out there and you could make it happen with those things, and there was lots of them to be had. So,
and the cool thing there is we, Steve Howard, one of the other guys in our group, he did some research and found this area that we could take our mountain bikes and trailers on. And that at the time was a huge focus for us, how we'd hunted here locally. And so we got to go out bike hunting after Rockies, which not a lot of people had done at that time. And, it was like Trent said, to go there, our first adventure, we all killed bulls, tagged out. So it was about the pinnacle as far as what you could do for an out-of-state over-the-counter, you know, or in the case of Wyoming, general tag. So
hold on a second, guys. You're making me sound pretty bad here. I'm sitting here for the last, you know, 6 months telling the listeners how, you know, I haven't killed an elk in 3 years and over 30 days of hunting, and you guys are saying you're going out and tagged out on your first year? That's not fair.
We were very fortunate.
But to preface that, we've all been bow hunting elk in our own state since, well, for me, since 1994.
Yeah, long time.
So this was not we've made and we still make tons of errors when it comes to elk hunting. This was just the first time that we ventured out of the state to do it. So
yeah.
No, I'm just messing around, but that's pretty awesome. And then after that, I just from again following along with you guys that you'd went to Colorado, and did pretty well there the first year that you were there, right?
Yeah, we did. We went to Colorado and picked a new spot, and I can't remember if we all tagged out. I think all but one tagged out, but yeah, it was a different learning experience as far as there was more people there. We definitely dealt with a lot more people than we did in Wyoming, and which wasn't a bad thing. It's just, you know, it was just a different hunt. The terrain was different. But that, I think that's what inspires me as much as Cody and I were just talking about this just a couple hours ago, as far as at the end of the day or at the end of our lives, how about that? I don't want to keep coming back to the same hunting spot. I just can't imagine like being, this is going to sound terrible probably, but like as far as whitetail hunting, and you guys, you go to the same tree every single year, you sit in the same stand and you do that. I mean, I think that would be totally awesome in the rut. But I just, man, we love to just venture, and the next adventure is just, it's just what's behind that next tree, what's over that next ridge, you know, and that's what it is for us. I think that's the alluring part of hunting different spots every year. So we went back actually to that same spot that you're talking about in Colorado the year after that we did so well. And what it gave us was preconceived notions of, this is going to be amazing, just like it was last year. And it wasn't. We could not find as many elk. It was like, okay, yeah, we're going to go up on this ridge where Cody killed his bull last year. There should be a bunch of bulls bugling again. And it wasn't, you know, and it almost, I'm not saying it ruined the hunt for us, but it made us change gears enough to hike out 8 miles and jump in the pickup, drive all night long, switching drivers, get to a trailhead at a whole different spot. I mean, 12-hour drive or something like that.
Yeah, it was not just like, oh, we're going to go here. No. We drove all the way across the state.
All the way across the state. Got to a trailhead with 10 times as many horse trailers and pickups and everything. But it was a new spot for us. And hike in 5-6 miles. And then we shot 2 more bulls in the next 3.5 days or something like that. So it was that part of it. It's not all about hunting and killing and everything to us. I think it's more about the adventure of getting there and experiencing that, you know?
Yeah.
And the allure with Land of the Free, that's what's really been awesome is just hunting different states, different, you know, styles, different terrain, you know, and having to adjust and do everything. But I think like Trent said, the having expectations of where if you've gone there before, you have an experience, you think it's going to be this or not, it may be better, maybe worse, but you still have expectations. And when we go to someplace new, it's like we hunt so much harder, we're way more thorough about it, and
we don't leave any stone unturned. No. if it's a new area, we will hike until we can't hike anymore to try to find, you know, one that wants to play.
Yeah, so it's basically like, so if you're going to the same area every year, you might say you didn't find an elk in this one little valley or whatever. The one year, the next year, you're going to be like, ah, there's nothing in there. I might go past it. Where if you're in a new area, you're just kind of testing out all the different ridges and just kind of exploring from that standpoint.
Totally, totally. And on the flip side of that, say you find them. That was what we experienced. We found them there the year before. And then the year after we came back, and you don't find anything, you know, where you know there's elk, quote unquote, team morale starts to take a dive. It's like, man, what are we doing here? They start second guessing, you know, why did we pick this spot instead of just going, oh, they're going to be over the next ridge. You're going, well, why aren't they right here? And it's that whole allure, I guess, of what's over the next ridge.
Yeah, and I met up with Ty Stubblefield a few years ago for the first time, and he was telling me a story of you guys in that Colorado hunt and everything. And when I was talking to Ty, I was like, hey, you know, it was right after my first year going out west, and I was like, what kind of, you know, advice can you give me with it? And he was like, if you're not finding elk, just keep moving. And that's the biggest thing I think that I took away from that. And I see that with you guys and watching, you know, some of the Land of the Free and everything else it seems like that, you know, if there's not elk there that you guys are moving. I hope that I'm not speaking out of turn there, but it kind of seems that way.
No, absolutely not. No, what we're doing is honestly, and when we produce a film, it's trying to make walking and bugling 200 times a day fun to watch trying to do. And anyway, but that's exactly what we do. We keep moving and keep bugling until we may pass by five different bulls that we don't know that are there, but if they're not wanting to play the game that we're playing, then we will walk right by them and keep looking for that one that does, you know?
Yeah. And so like you guys are real big on like, you know, the team aspect, and your group is rather large at most times when you're out hunting. How do you kind of split up when you're doing that? Cause you seem to share, you know, the same camp, but how are you splitting up the roles, I guess?
Yeah, sometimes we draw cards there's, you know, as far as we're pretty good about the whole team is like, you know, we're all in it for the same goal, right? So we're all in it to try and consistently harvest elk. And so we'll put certain guys in certain positions with guys that haven't, you know, done as much elk hunting or something. And that was the difference of the Land of the Free between anything else we've done. It was team oriented, but we're taking on people that we've never hunted with before. So right off the bat, you're trying to figure out how their hunting style works into our hunting style, and then, you know, kind of divvy up into teams and figure out how all that works out. And then in the middle, sometimes we switch it up just so we can hunt with different people and be around different people. And I mean, hunting isn't, I mean, I guess I just said we're looking to kill elk. Yes, but it's still, I mean, even a notch tag is not the goal every single time. It's success is not measured, I would say, in notching a tag. It's the camaraderie with friends. It's the learning every single year that you're out there. It's because I'm sure, I mean, you said that you've been out there for, what, 30 days already and hadn't happened, punched a tag, but you would not ever, I would imagine, say that your season wasn't successful.
No. I mean, this year specifically in 2018 there, I spent 14 days straight in Colorado, and it was really, really tough. And then I had a lot of opportunities that, you know, either I screwed up or, you know, there's a million variables when it comes to elk hunting. But when I came home from that, I just was like, I can't wait to go back out next year, yeah. You know, and people from the outside may look at it as how do you spend that much time, you know, hunting elk and not come home with something and still want to keep going out. But I don't know what the drive is, but it's really cool. And so from a whitetail standpoint, from where I'm coming from, it's not your typical whitetail country, as I live in the middle of 2 million acres of public land in northern Pennsylvania, and it's all big woods, you know, Appalachian Mountain type terrain. And we have like a family atmosphere where we're all into bow hunting and, you know, take off for a couple of weeks during the rut from work and hunt. But for the most part, it's a solo, you know, type endeavor. I mean, you're not sitting in a tree stand with someone, you know, and going elk hunting is just, that's, I think that's what's really brought me to it, is getting to go with a bunch of people. Or, you know, I spent the first 8 days with my dad this year out there. And then after that, met up with a group of four other guys and just had a blast getting to do that and getting to work with, you know, different people. And then, you know, when you come back to camp or whatever it is, or in the middle of the day, after, you screw up a couple encounters and, you know, just kind of laughing about it and everything together, that those experiences for me personally were just, are hard to come by otherwise.
I would totally agree.
Yeah. And that's just it. Like the success of that experience and the base that you're building, it's just going to make you want to do it more and get better at it. So,
I mean, don't get me wrong. I really want to kill an elk, but don't get me wrong there, but
I promise you it will happen. I promise you it will.
Yeah. And it's funny, when I was talking to Corey, I was like, hey, you know, I just need, just give me that one tip that makes me kill an elk. And I was just joking with him back and forth, and he starts laughing. He goes, the only way you'll fail is if you quit, you know?
That's a fact.
100%.
So that's, and I think this year I'm going to try another state. I've hunted in Colorado for 3 years now and three different locations. Always started at the same spot, but kind of moved around a lot. And it was funny. I started at like between 11 and 12,000 feet this year where I was finding them in previous years. And it was so dry. I don't know if you guys experienced that, but it was really, really dry. And all the elk weren't in the high country where I'd found them in the past. That was starting in September 1st and ended up moving down and had six different bull encounters on day like 11 to 13. And it was all down at like 75 to 8,000 feet. So
yeah,
it's crazy to kind of change
where we hunt, probably somewhere in like in Colorado, 85 to 9 is where we have normally hunted. But I'm not saying it's elevation based at all. I'm just saying that's kind of where we have hunted and got into them.
Yeah. Did you guys have a pretty dry year out there this year?
Honestly, it was the driest I've ever had as far as during season. Leading up to season, I'm not positive of how all that went as far as that goes. But this whole year, I went from August 24th, I think it was, to the end of September. And I think I saw maybe a tiny little drizzle, maybe two times. That was it, the whole season. Whereas last year, I got dumped snow, sub-zero temperatures. It's miserable, horrible. Yeah. And this year was, I mean, it was almost pleasurable. Like when I was awesome. In Wyoming, what was that, the 10th through the 20th? I think mm-hmm. in Wyoming, it was like 83 degrees a few of the days. It was Jeez. It was hot. It was super, super hot. So totally different.
Yeah, it's funny. Like you said last year in 2017 there, yeah, I went from, you know, having waking up to a blanket of snow and the next morning and just having storms that were terrible, lightning storms, rain, all this stuff, to this year I spent 14 days out there. I think I pulled my rain jacket out once.
Yeah.
It was interesting. But anyways, I kind of want to go back into the whole partner aspect that you have there. And does it, I mean, I know like most of you guys within Born and Raised have hunted together for a long time, but now you're kind of, you know, meeting up with a whole bunch of different groups and, you know, other influencers and other, you know, teams of guys there. What's that like, and how do you kind of create that group dynamic that you guys have spent so long to build together?
You know, that was the one thing that we were all super nervous about last year, because we had never, outside of us, five of us with Ty, had never shared an elk camp with anybody. So it was really nerve-wracking, honestly, you know. But for the most part, we knew everyone pretty well. We'd spent some time outside of, you know, hunting with people. But it's different, I will say, a mountain, you get to see a true person's aspect, who they are, character-wise, everything. And so it was nerve-wracking, like, how is this all going to shake out? And it was pretty amazing. And the brotherhood bonds, you know, like when you build a bond on the mountain, it's like a lifetime bond. And so after last year's experience, you know, it was like, bring it on again this year. And it, I think for the most part, everyone else embraced it just the way that we did too. And, you know, kind of seeked that brotherhood, that partnership, and really embraced it. So,
yeah. When you guys are hunting, like when you were hunting in Oregon and stuff, were you doing any like backpack hunting, or was it mostly come from the truck?
In Oregon?
Yeah.
Mostly. A lot of Oregon was from the pickup. We never, there's where we hunt around here, there's so many, we hunt a lot of private timberlands. It's open to the public. It's open to the public, but it's a lot of just walk-in road access. So you can't spend the night a lot of times in some of the places that we hunt. Some of them you can, but there's so many roads and there's so many opportunity just to hit another spot. You know, it's like we might as well just keep mobile. And so we'll go in and then hike out that same day, or just make a hunt through, you know, and come out that same day in Oregon and just share like a spike camp kind of a thing.
By the truck, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, by the trucks and stuff.
And we're pretty low key. Like our camps literally is a cooler in the tailgate and throw out a sleeping bag either in the truck or down the ground on a canvas cutter or whatever, and that's it.
Everything, we're everywhere we go, honestly, throughout the whole season is – keyword mobile. We are mobile the whole time. We do not like set up the big wall tent usually. I mean, it's happened like in Montana last year. That was just our base camp and we hunted from that, from days away from that. But no, it's usually we are very, very mobile. If we're not finding them one day in one spot, we are jumping in the truck and we are driving, you know, an hour or two to go somewhere else and check there. So
yeah,
mobility is key.
Yeah, I think this year in Colorado, when I went back to the same spot that I was normally backpacking in, I noticed that I ended up was backpacking, you know, way back in and then hunting back towards the truck where I was finding these elk and just like some of these somewhat overlooked spots. And this year I truck camped. I had gotten one of those rooftop tents. I put one of those James Brood USA, the rooftop tents on, and then just kept everything in the back of my cap. And that was really helpful when, you know, if we weren't finding elk to be able to move, like you said, being mobile like that, I could pack up the truck, close everything up in, you know, 15, 20 minutes and be on the road or do whatever. And that was kind of cool to be able to do that. And not to mention have less weight on your back when you're hiking out or hiking around during the day.
Yeah. One thing I would like to add too to that is, as you said, you backpacked in and then you found elk kind of hiking back. A lot of people, and especially maybe coming from back east, you hear this, everybody's throwing around this term backcountry hunter, backcountry, we're in the backcountry. The thing that I've learned in the last 2 years, more than any time that I've ever hunted actually, is a lot of the elk that we've found that in high numbers and great calling scenarios are within that 1 to 2 miles from the road. You do not have to get in 10 to 12 miles or 8 miles or whatever, and, or be the elitist of the elite and be, you know, you do not have to be that guy to do this. Anybody can do this. You can hunt, you can kill bulls, you can bugle them in to the road. Honestly, we've done it. I've seen it. It's happened right to the gravel. So, I mean, you don't have to be the Cameron Haynes, which, I mean, that guy is an animal, but I'm just saying, I'm using him as a reference as the elitist of the elite. You don't really, anybody can do this. Don't let that barrier be like, well, I'm not in good enough shape to do this. Yeah. If you can get a mile, a half a mile off a road, you can be a backcountry hunter as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Cody, do you have any input on that as well?
No, I think the biggest thing that we've learned, like you said, is being mobile, the willingness to move. You know, I think so many people get married to, well, I scouted this on Google Earth or on Onyx. I want to hunt this area because it's got what the elk want, and they hunt the country and not the elk. And so a lot of times they get that tunnel vision. No, this is what I have planned. And they're not willing to adapt. And I think that's where a lot of people, I mean, not the term fail, but they just get stuck down this. And it kind of goes back to that comfort zone because they're not, well, I don't have another plan. I don't know this country. I'd never looked at this or scouted it, e-scouted it on Onyx. So I'm not going to go do it. And, you know, you have to adapt throughout the season, throughout the hunt. And like you said, this year, you know, the elk weren't high because the snowpack wasn't there, so it didn't green up, you know, or it dried up sooner, so those elk dropped out of the elevation. Your willingness to change got you into those elk. And I think the thing for us, like, we will backpack, we will truck camp, we will road bugle, you know, so like it all depends on what we're finding for sign and what the elk densities. And if the elk densities are really low, the best way to cover ground is with a vehicle. So, you know, if you go in backpacking and there's not the elk population there, you're literally hunting for those, that one herd or, you know, small pockets. And you're really, you know, shooing yourself into limiting what your encounters are going to be based on that, just because you wanted to experience a backpack hunt. So the willingness to adapt, change, move, and go for it. So
yeah, I mean that's an interesting point, and I'm glad you guys brought that up about, you know, that 1 to 2 mile range and not, I mean, like when I said, when I got I guess introduced to the, you know, the whole backcountry hunting, you know, scene and everything, I read that book and I was like, I gotta go way back in there. I gotta, you know, that's the only way I'm gonna kill elk, because if I get way back in. And it was funny that I ended up finding these elk in this little pocket that was, I don't even know if it was a mile from the road, to be honest with you, but it was just a trail ran up the ridge and people would get to this one point and they'd bugle off the point and not hear anything, and they keep go, and they go up to the high country and go off, you know, one of the ridges, and just getting down to that little steep valley. I, for 2 years in a row, I messed up more opportunities than, you know, most people would dream of. And just from a lack of experience and knowing what to do, you know, I wish I could have those chances back, but, nonetheless, it was just interesting to me that's where the elk were, because everything I read and everything I listened to was, you know, they're not that close to the truck. There's so much pressure there. Well, it all depends on each area. And like you said, just being willing to, I guess, adapt to it. That's a very, really good point, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing, we've learned this over the years, you know, before it's like, nope, this is what we're doing. We hunted this way. And then as we've come into airs and getting so dedicated into one spot, and that's when we've kind of evolved in the backpack hunting to now carrying camp on our back, and you just end up where you end up and just kind of go with the flow. So,
yeah. I understand that. So I mean, if you watch any of your YouTube videos, it's not hard to tell that your strategy is, you know, and as Trent said a little bit earlier, bugle and hike and bugle, you know. And so if you do get an elk to respond, what is kind of like what's your first thing that comes to your mind?
First thing ever should be wind every single time. That's why everybody asks us, well, what scent do you use, or what cover scent, or whatever. We don't use anything. We don't shower for months on end sometimes, and hiking, you know, every hundreds of miles a week, we do not use any scents. So we just rely on the little puffer bottle. The little smoke in a bottle is your best friend as far as number one. When you get a bugle, it's all about wind. And so there's be a lot of times that it's wind doesn't just, you know, it's not just right now. So you've got to kind of be a little bit adaptive as far as, okay, right now it's 8 a.m. The wind is sucking downhill. It's going to be doing that for probably another hour and a half to 2 hours, you know, you're 10:30 or so. And then that wind's going to be really, really fickle. It'll be, you know, switching on and off after the thermals come up. Be aware of which side the sun's coming up on. If it's coming up on the opposite side of where you want to hunt, which would be good. That sun's going to pull the wind. There's so many things as far as just wind alone that a guy needs to look into and just kind of realize that if they smell you, it's over with. They can see you. They can hear you. I mean, we make a ton of noise. And you can still sometimes, you know, get away with it. But if they smell you, it's pretty much
game over. Yeah.
Okay. So real quick before we keep going down that road, Trent, I heard you talking on a podcast that you said you change your socks every single day, but you don't change your underwear very often. What's going on with that?
You've seen Forrest Gump, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Nobody wants swamp foot. Okay. So no, I carry a ton of socks with me. My underpants, on the other hand, I just, once you get that layer of grime on there, just keep it, because it helps you out in the long run.
It's interesting because I've always had foot issues, and I probably don't do a good a job changing my socks. I've kind of played around with liners and not, and Trent on the other hand does it, but he changes his socks every day, fresh pair before he goes to sleep.
Oh yeah.
You know, so I had rotten foot at the end of it.
It was pretty ranky.
Yeah. Everyone would be walking behind. And it was interesting, like my boots stunk so bad, but it wasn't until you walk through some wet grass in the morning and then all of a sudden people behind me are like, what is that smell? It's like, yeah, it's my feet. Sorry.
I'm not going to lie, brother. It gets by the end of 40 some odd days, we get smelling pretty good.
It gets weird, huh?
It gets weird.
Yeah.
It just gets weird.
I know when I was in Colorado again this year, I did this. I brought I think I had three pairs of socks. I just kept like interchanging them and bought the same amount of pair of underwear. I wear merino wool, darn tough socks and everything. But anyways, I switch out my socks every night, but I just keep going back and forth to the different, you know, pairs, I guess. And I thought I was doing good. I'm like, look at this, no stink, merino wool, I'm doing well. And then I was sleeping in my own tent. And then like on day 13 or so, one of the other guys went in my tent. I had a teepee set up and I was storing all the gear in there. And another person joined us. So he moved in the tent with me and he's like, holy cow, do you stink in here? I thought I was doing pretty good, but
I think you get immune to it. That's what you do get immune to it, but that's another thing. Steve Speck, actually, he's a great backpack hunter, been doing it a long time. He's probably one of the elitists as far as weight and ounces and cutting pounds and stuff. And what he'll do, I saw, is he keeps like little carabiners on his pack and he'll just get to a crick, wash out his socks. He'll only take two pairs with him the whole hunt and he'll wash his socks in the crick and then just carabiner them onto his pack. He's got little holes on them, mm-hmm. just carabiners them right on the back of his pack. So they just flap in the wind all day. They dry out, their merino wool as well. And dry out, and that's how he does it, which was interesting. Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty,
yeah,
pretty. Huh. I want some from a washing machine. I carry on a trick like last year. I think I had 37 pairs of socks. I think I brought.
Yeah. Wow, that's funny. But no, that's a good. I never thought of that as far as hang drying them on your pack like that. You know, I always would stuff them in my sleeping bag and, you know, try to use my body heat to dry them and stuff like when they get sweaty, but I've washed them in a crick or whatever and tried air drying them that way. That's interesting.
Yeah. And for the most part, like I said, weather wise during September, it's not a big deal. It's totally feasible to do. So,
yeah. All right, back on track. Let's go back. When you check the wind and everything there, you have the smoke in the bottle and everything's working out and you're heading towards the elk. What are you doing from that point? So you're typically in a team of two or three guys. What are you doing from there?
I think the biggest factor is time of day and when that response happens. You know, morning time, typically those elk are heading from feeding to a bedding area. So they're very vocal. They sound off a lot. They respond. And a lot of people, you know, the bull bugles, but then he bugles and he's further away. And so they immediately are like, oh, he's pushing his cows away from me. Well, 99% of the time that their lead cow's already going in a direction where they want to go bed and that bull's following, or, you know, they're heading to that comfort zone. So not necessarily moving away from you. So you kind of assess the situation based on the time of day. If a bull cracks off at 1 o'clock and it's a kind of a light bugle, it's a bedded bull bugle, then it's like, okay, game on. We know he's in a, you know, a single position, and then you can kind of plan accordingly. And then evening times, we've killed a lot of bulls in the afternoon and evenings too, as they're coming out of their bedding area. So it's again kind of assessing that time of day to know what your next step is. Morning time, if that bull is bugling, we just stay chase and play the chase game and just stay on as much as we can, get him to stay vocal and kind of pinpoint where he is. We've definitely, I would say, matured our program a little bit as time's gone on and understand, you know, we'll wait and push instead of pushing on them exactly right out of the gate, you know, trying to kill those bulls midday, follow them to their bedding area sometimes. And we'll have them shut up for a while. We'll let them rest for an hour or whatever, slip in and call them out of their bed. So we talk about this the last 2 years, it has not been the case, but we usually kill bulls from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. typical where we perform. This year, we definitely killed a few that way, but it wasn't wasn't as prevalent. So, and then trying to determine an exact location and or distance, and that's probably the biggest challenge when a bull cracks off is trying to figure out where they're at and how far away. And that all's like terrain dictates how far that sound's going
to
travel.
And there's so many, it's tough to say, and that's, I will preface everything that we're saying, obviously, with every single situation's different. Don't approach it like, well, Cody said that I could just go in there and just shoot it right. You know, it is very difficult. Each one is different. Like this year, another thing that Cody kind of touched on is how many bulls are in the area. You know, if there's a bunch of bulls in the area, a lot of times you either have to get really close or before you start calling for them to give you a look. It's just every situation is totally, totally different. This year with my bull in Wyoming that I shot, we had to suck in so tight. We heard him from a long distance away and bugling up to them and kind of bugling as you get towards them wasn't working as well. So we just shut up and we just kind of predicted, okay, we think he's right about here, and got clear up there and bugled one time. Steve bugled one time and the bull, it came just right in. So I mean, it's just every situation's different. Colorado, where the bull to cow ratios are so high, it's going to be different there too, rather than, let's say, Oregon, Roosevelt, where your bull to cow ratios are super, super low. And, we've always said we'd rather call a Roosevelt any day of the week rather than a Rocky Mountain bull any day of the week, just because they're, if you can get them to bugle, you have a good opportunity, if you can get the wind right, to shoot that elk. So it's just every situation is different.
Yeah, like on to touch on that, like typically we like to move in, you know, and get as tight as possible before we go after them and make that challenge. Case in point, this year in Montana, we had a couple bulls come in from a long ways away, 300, 400, 500, 600 yards. And where normally we would have been caught busted moving on them, we set up and let that kind of situation develop. But there was lower elk densities there. The bulls were pretty hot to go fight each other versus Colorado, where we just came from, where there was a lot of bulls. But they weren't, you know, it's like, no, I got my little one or two, three cows and I'm not going to fight. And so, it all kind of depends on the attitude and what the surrounding population's doing and what I guess the answer is there's no formula to it. It just,
we're beating all over the bush here, buddy.
No, yeah. I noticed from your videos and stuff that you're hunting a lot of, I mean, now that you're hunting all over, it's a little bit different. For the majority, like in Colorado and stuff, you're hunting a lot of that dark timber. And
absolutely.
And that's absolutely. And that's like the whole area that I had been hunting was basically nothing but dark timber. And that it can be one tough to figure out exactly where the elk are when they bugle. And it's an interesting dynamic with all the blowdowns and everything else, to get it done in those type of environments.
Yeah, no, totally. And that is a little bit helpful by hunting with a crew other than just individually, because there's always two guys that point one way and then the other guy that points a total different direction where he heard the bugle, you know? And so we try to narrow it down to, okay, well, you know, let's try it again. Everybody, you know, cup your ears or whatever you got to do to try to figure out, then pinpoint the location and the distance and the direction that the bugle's coming from. It's a tough deal sometimes, especially with just a little tiny bit of wind. It's really tough.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you were to go back to what you were saying about like the mornings, chasing the bugles and again, for me, in my limited experience elk hunting, I've heard more of the bugles, you know, in the first thing in the morning, and I got in that game of chasing them. And it just seems like, you know, they were doing the same thing, and it took me a while to realize, you know, they're just following the cows. You know, the cows aren't pulling them away. They were going up to bed. And then one time I actually had it work out where I followed them up and got to where they're bedded and got the bull, you know, out. I kind of waited him out a little bit and got the bull out of his bed, and then just had a wind issue, as you said, the first the first thing that they're going to catch you with is the wind. And that happened. I mean, the bull was only at, I think, 12 yards, but it was just so thick with those blowdowns and stuff. It's amazing how difficult it can be.
Sounds like you're hunting where we were.
it can be really thick. And
Oh man.
I was in a wilderness area and it was just, I couldn't even explain it. Like when I tried telling people about the blowdowns, I was like, when I get back from there, I'm like, I do not want to see another tree laying down ever again. Cause they're not like little trees most of the time either, you know?
I know. Yeah, it's a pain in the butt.
Our shins are scarred.
I bet.
Colorado.
Just ask Dirk.
He has a heck of a time. But yeah, we'll call it, we have different names for a lot of the stuff. But like you were just saying, following them and we'll call it like slow playing. So we'll find a bull that's responsive, but he's still moving and we can kind of pinpoint his direction. So sometimes we'll just sit down and slow play it out. And a lot of times we're slow playing for not just him to bed down, but for the wind. Sometimes we'll slow play for a lot of different reasons. And that's what we call it. We just say, yeah, let's just slow play this one. Let's sit back, have lunch, get a snack, whatever, and let him kind of calm down and then go in and approach him on a whole different, you know, different angle or a different whatever bugle, everything different than we just did before that we just, you know, didn't figure out or screwed up on. And we do that a lot too as well.
We also do the rambush.
Yes, that's been done as well.
The rambush.
Rambush is pretty much the last option on the table. That nothing else has worked so far, so we're gonna try to run them down and run at them and act like a bull. And it has definitely.
I don't think it's ever like worked as far as 100% dead.
Yeah, but we at least finally got to see him or have an encounter.
Yeah, we've darn close a few times.
But it basically it's just being over the top aggressive and going right at him. So it's definitely that's one of the cards that we don't like to play, but. If it's the last card in the deck, then we're going to play it.
It usually results in an elk running out of the country. Yeah. But at least you get to see him.
Yeah. I remember the a time when my brother and I were going down through this valley and we heard a bull chuckle like not very far away. It's out of nowhere. And we hadn't heard anything. And I don't know what it was. I remember it was my second year. And I remember people telling me I need to be more aggressive. Don't hunt them like whitetails. Be aggressive. So I'm like, I just took off running at it. Not, you know, again, I just went into a mode that I can't describe, but kind of went running at the bull. I mean, I dropped my bugle tube and everything and my brother picked it up behind me and started calling and I got close, but I got a little bit too close, I think. And they all blew out of there. And like you said, they were up and over the ridge before I could even see what they were doing.
They've got long legs.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
I'm like, that would take me until 2 p.m. to get up to that point. And they just did that in 5 minutes. I don't
know.
But, you know, I guess that's how it works. But when you guys, again, are calling together and everything, how are you staying on the same page? Are you staying within sight of each other or how does that work?
So that's a great question. We usually, first of all, we try to stay inside of each other. It doesn't always happen depending on the situation, but we always have call signs. So we always have hand signals that the caller can do because the caller is the caller, the shooter is the shooter for us. And so the caller, or I'm sorry, the shooter is actually out front. He's on the front lines. And so he can see sometimes what the bull's doing, whereas the caller can't. And so if that bull, every time you chuckle and that bull will rake a tree or something, and it's getting him more fired up and everything. So you will, you know, do obviously the hand signal back to rake a tree to your caller to let him know that's what's working. So it's that communication there in between. So we try to keep in contact. We try to keep in eyesight of each other. And I'm saying there's sometimes in super thick stuff, it'll only be 30 yards. And there's sometimes it'll be 70 to 100. You just never, you know, every situation's a little different on how every single bull responds is just a little different. So, yeah, but we try definitely. There's been times it's like, we could have really, really changed the game, I think, if I could have just told him to do X, cow call more, or to, you know.
So we've got the hand signal of the hand swiping over the head is like the cow call, like no horns, just, and then, tip.
The hang loose signal in front of your lips is
like
bugle.
You're bugling on your thumb to your pinky, bugle. And then just for vocal side of it, the shooter moves up silently. When he's set up and ready, he gives one cow call. And that's like, okay, I'm ready to shoot. Go ahead and start calling. And then if you need to move up, you do three quick cow calls. And that's for that you're moving up or the caller needs to move up. So
three quick cow calls in the same tone. Yeah, the same tone. And then that alerts the caller to, okay, I need to go where the shooter's at to at least get an eyesight, and so we can get some better hand signals. So it, like I said, every single situation is different, but it really helps the whole fluency of the whole dance, I should say, if everybody's kind of on the same page and you kind of know exactly what the shooter wants when he wants it, you know.
So when you have, like, when you're hunting again with these different people and these different groups of people, do you go over this stuff ahead of time and talk about
absolutely.
It?
Okay. Yeah, yep. Absolutely. Yeah, there's a team meeting before. Okay, this is how it's going to go down. If just in case this happens, this is how we're going to approach it. Oh yeah, that's all talked about before we start the first calling situation.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Like you said, with the hand signals and everything else, and even doing the cow calls, that's it definitely takes everyone being on the same page for that to all work out in your favor.
Absolutely. It can make or break a hunt, honestly.
Yeah.
It really can.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's...
Yeah, we definitely learned...
No, go ahead.
We definitely learned last year early on because we didn't communicate. You know, it was like we were just so in tune. We were like, us at Born and Raised, we hunted together so much. We were kind of a well-oiled machine. And then someone else came in and didn't, you know, we didn't talk about it. And we're like, well, yeah, when we cow call, you're supposed to move up. Oh, sorry. You know, so we had some steep learning curves on communication, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. As far as your setup, so like the shooter and the caller, so depending on which way the bull's coming in, is like the caller shifting around or trying to do something to make the bull go a certain direction? Do you go with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and it worked a lot this year too. And that's what's one thing I would tell any of your listeners is bulls usually they're going to like the high ground, or they don't attendantly. I mean, I'm just talking to every situation is different, but what we've learned a lot is get on their ground, get on the same level as that bull. They are so much more willing to come in on a side hill than to come up at you if you're up above them, or even come down at you, because they want to see something. A bull wants to see something. That's that they come just as far as they can, but after their, you know, their sound and everything and all that gets to them, they want to use their sight to see something. So what we do is try to get on their level. So we'll try, if the wind allows it, try to scoot up and try to get side hill of that bull. And it's happened numerous times, and this year was a great example a bunch of different times as far as finally got on his level, and then he got mad enough to say, okay, I'm coming across there to check this out. So that would be one thing that I would definitely recommend.
Okay. So getting on the same level as far as that goes, I mean, so you're saying the bull likes to, you know, see something as he's coming across. Are you doing anything like with the caller, you know, waving a stick or a branch or anything to give him a visual, or are you still trying to kind of stay, you know, invisible there?
I think this year, I mean, I would go as far to say as maybe we've dropped a little bit of a ball on the decoy side of things. I think there is definitely something there. We killed Trevor's bull last year in Idaho, and that bull came from like 700 yards. And we had some elk butt decoys. We had two decoys, I think, out. And I mean, we were almost waving, you know, them, kind of moving them. And that bull definitely saw those this year. Tyler killed his bull, I think, honestly, because not just because of the decoy, but it calmed him down. I think it was definitely something that worked in our favor on that setup. So yeah, I would like to, in the future, I'm going to start using decoys more. I think we're going to implement them a lot more than we have been in the past. But yeah, they want to see something, and they're hearing all this noise. They're hearing these limbs break, these trees, you know, get raked and everything, but yet they're not seeing any other elk down there, you know, or over there or whatever, you know? And so it's definitely something that we've been implementing more is a decoy.
Yeah. And I did, I learned after watching some stuff with Dirk, shaking a tree, we've at times implemented that where, you know, you're shaking a tree, like you're raking, stop, bugle, shake the tree, and I've watched bulls like, oh, okay, yeah, there's a bull right there. And it enables the bull, like this was particularly where the bull actually winded us, busted us, and then stood up on the high ground. Well, enabled Trent to go for a sneak on that bull while he was locked into this tree, kind of zoned in on that, and, you know, almost killed him, just didn't work out. And I used that in Idaho this year, shaking a tree out and some stuff, and the bull locked in right to that and enabled Stephen Mark to get in close, just no shot. So
yeah.
Visual is huge, but I think the biggest thing, setup of the shooter is 100% critical. Be the succeeding factor or the failure factor. And a lot of people are afraid to move to get set up to where they're going to be able to get a shot, and they hang back because they don't want to mess it up. And the biggest thing there is if that bull's coming in and like Trent said, that he wants to see something. So he comes to this point and breaks over, and he's going to look to where that sound was. And if he can't see anything, that's where he's going to stop. And 99% of the time, that's where that bull, where he first comes and where he can get a look, he's going to stop. And if he doesn't see anything, then it's going to start to slow down the process of him coming in. And so you have to be able to shoot that elk where he comes out in that first opportunity where he's going to see where the caller is standing from. And I think getting in that position is the critical point and is going to make or break your setup. So being cognitive of like how that terrain lays and like, okay, well, he's over here. He's going to come over this finger ridge. When he crests out on that finger ridge, I've got to be able in a spot to have him in range and where I can get a shot. Or a lot of times he'll come up over that finger ridge. You're 60 yards from it. He comes out. It's frontal. Then he turns around and leaves. Well, if he leaves, that gives you the ability to move up. And now you can call that bull back. And they'll come back to a spot that they've been before time and time again. They'll come up and rake a tree and then lose interest and maybe go back over the finger ridge, get up now to where you can move to shoot that spot exactly where that elk came out before. So
it's a great point.
Yeah. And so what you just said there about how that the elk will come back to that same spot. Again, an experience in Colorado I had this past year was two of the guys that I was hunting with, they were set up on the opposite side. We were actually in like a creek bottom, and this bull that we had kind of put to bed earlier in the morning, and he shut up. So we kind of moved on and came back a little bit later. We called him in. It was a nice 7x6, came through the opening. I'm calling from across the creek, and they're over there on the opposite side. And this was down when we were in the lower elevation, so there's a bunch of oak brush. But anyways, this bull came in to like, I don't know, it looked for me about 20 yards from those guys, and they're at full draw. And to me, it looked wide open. Why weren't they shooting? Well, apparently the oak brush was a little bit too high, but that bull wouldn't see anything. He would leave and we'd call again. He'd come back to the exact same spot. He did it like four or five times. He just couldn't get a shot on him. It was just interesting to see how they do that. He wouldn't come any closer because at that point it was, you know, although the brush was thick, he could see if there would have been another elk there, and sure, just wouldn't come any further and hit any of those open spots. So that's kind of interesting that you guys said that as well.
Yeah, no. And that, I mean, we've learned that over the years. Sometimes you don't know where that spot is going to be, where they're going to hang up. But if it does happen, let them walk away, let the caller be quiet for just that little bit to where you can move up. And if the wind's good, cover as much ground as fast as you can, slip up there, you know, and then let them start the calling sequence again. And a lot of times they're like, oh, okay. And I'll come back over to that. Literally the exact same spot a lot of times.
That's how Casey killed his bull in Oregon this year, is those bulls were hanging just up on this hillside. We knew right where they'd come. And so we let them go off. We let them wander off. And without saying a word, we just were silent. And then we got right up to that spot, called again, and the bull came back.
Yeah. Curiosity will kill him.
Yep.
Gotcha. And to add to that a little bit, you know, you said they're going to go back to the same spot. So when, after the fourth time of that happening, I ended up running down to the creek and I saw where the bull was coming back across. I ranged the spot where same place he came before. It was 52 yards dialed in my sight and waited. And that bull was, I had my pressure on the release getting ready to draw back. And the communication between myself and the shooters wasn't there. Like, I never told them or gave them any signal that I was running down there. And then they bugled and that bull just stopped and went right back towards them again. And then ended up not getting close enough, but it was just that communication thing back and forth that, you know, resulted in that not, you know, at least not having the opportunity at them. But, yeah. But the bull was doing the same exact thing because, like you said, I guess he knew he was safe there before. So why not, you know, do it again?
Yeah, exactly. We've seen that lots and lots of times.
Mm-hmm. So that's definitely an interesting point. And as far as like the setup with the shooter, are you guys standing like, you know, in front of the trees and or whatever, or a bush or whatever it may be? Are you making sure that you have nothing in front of you, or are you standing kind of behind it?
Yeah, Cody touched on this a little bit, just a little bit ago, but that is the biggest thing I think about it as far as first time or are new to elk hunting and setups and stuff. Set up in front of something, set up in the shade. Don't be right in the sunlight. Try and set up kind of concealed behind you, but set up so you can move 180 degrees. So you can draw your bow. You're not hitting anything with your arm or anything, and just have the background behind you, a broken up background, so you're not right out in the opening, you know, like in a meadow or anything like that. Have a tree behind you, something preferably with low hanging limbs or something to kind of break that up. But yeah, do not, we've seen it a lot of times, guys will set up right in the brushiest, thickest spot where if a bull does come in, you'll be concealed. Yeah. But you can't get a shot at him, you know? So your number one thing is I need to get an arrow from this bow towards that elk. So you got to think about that first and foremost, and then thinking about your mobility. So when you go to set up, another great thing too is right when you go up there and you're picking a spot for a setup, you look behind you, you get out of the sun, you find a shady spot, you get in front of a tree, you have at least two shooting lanes. Give yourself a couple of lanes, and as long as you can, you know, as far of distance as you can is what I'm trying to say. And then clear the ground out below you, you know, because you want the caller to be making all the noise. You want to be like a fly on the wall. You do not want to be there. And you don't want the elk to know you're there. So clear out your feet, you know, all around your feet and everything. So if you have to rotate your body, you aren't going to break a bunch of sticks or something, and the elk is going to, you know, hear that and key in on you. So these are just little things that, honestly, one stick, if you think about it, could ruin a, you know, a bull of a lifetime, really. So, I mean, think about these little tiny things before you get in that situation. Just makes your opportunity of shooting that elk so much higher.
Gotcha. So the last point I want to just comment on there is, all right, so the bull comes in, and Cody, you touched on a little bit, and Trent, you as well, with you have to be ready as soon as that bull gives you that opportunity, whether it's cresting the ridge or whatever it is, to shoot. And I think a lot of times, especially coming from, you know, the East, you know, we're always waiting for that perfect, you know, opportunity. And I mean, you definitely want to, you know, wait for some sort of ethical shot and making sure that you understand the anatomy of the elk and everything else. But at the same time, I don't think I've seen a perfect opportunity. So what's kind of your comments on that for making the shot happen?
You got to kill them the first opportunity you can. I mean, I think this is where there's 90, you can get 90% of the way, a lot of people, but that 10% of the act of killing is somewhat making your opportunity happen. And so it's putting yourself in the right position, knowing when to draw, where to be set up. Like a lot of people, you know, that bull's coming in, they draw their bow, but now they're following the bull instead of already looking where that bull's path is and saying, okay, there's my shooting lane. I'm anchored aiming at that shooting lane. The bull's going to come in. He's going to take a step and a half after I call. So I need to call right as his first leg comes into the shooting lane, call, stop him, and shoot him, versus standing there, knowing the bull's in range, not drawing your bow. Oh, here he comes into the shooting lane, trying to draw. All of a sudden he walks to the shooting lane. Now you're in that scramble mode. You have to have like a little bit of preconceived planning as to what that bull's going to do, where can I kill him, what are the opportunities, and then execute based on what that bull's actions are. So,
and a lot of that comes into that pre-planning, like I was talking about, like getting your spot, that it starts with picking where you want to set up. And then it goes from there to clearing out. What I do is I clear out where my feet are going to be. And so I can rotate my body. And then from then on, it's ranging. So I need ranges on everything. I need to know if he comes in the furthest spot. I need to know what that range is into the closest spot. So I'm going through markers in my head right at that moment. This is before I even ever tell the caller to start calling. All this is done and trying to get your head dialed right. So you already think through that shot before you even see the animal, before you even think he's in the forest with you. You've already gone through all these steps in your head to where when the bull comes in, it's just second nature. You've already done it in your mind. And you said, okay, if he's right there, I'm going to shoot him for 25 yards and I'm going to pick this spot. You know, and so this is what I would tell everybody, as far as there's never a perfect situation, but you can always pre-plan things in your head. So all that has gone through, all that shot process has gone through your head before it even happens, to where when it does happen, it's just like it's second nature. You've already done it once almost, and you just all you have to do is execute the shot.
Gotcha. All right. Well, thanks for that, guys. And I've kept you here for quite a while now. We're hitting about the hour mark. So I just wanted to ask one other thing here. You guys definitely are not afraid to preach, you know, just to get out there and hunt and go do it. And with that being said, is there any, like, say, one piece of gear for each of you that you can't go without? We'll start with you, Trent.
One piece of gear that I can't go without.
I could say one answer that he is a quilt that he will not
use. Yeah, that's probably not going to happen next year.
I'm going to guess that you're going to say a wind checker, but I don't know. That's just my thought.
No. Honestly, I wouldn't say a wind checker just because if I don't have a sleeping bag, I'm going to freeze to death. No, my whole thing is comfortability. So, and especially talking to new guys that have been out there, the wind checker, it's going to be in your pack anyway. But my whole thing is comfortability. It would be your clothing and it would be your sleeping bag, your sleeping equipment. Because if you're out there and you get soaking wet and you get miserable, that is going to not only ruin your trip, but it's going to really limit your time that you want to be in the, you know, you want to be out there, and it's going to ruin your success rate. I mean, phenomenally. So I would say it would be sleeping bag, being comfortable and in any elements, whether it be snow, whether it be 90 degrees, being comfortable in that would be my, I guess, recommendation is prep for whatever happens so that it does not ruin your hunt. So you can stay out there longer. So your chances of success go up tremendously. Is what I would say.
Good answer. What about you, Cody?
For me, I mean, I would say the the number one thing, tool that we use the most is a diaphragm call and a bugle. And having spares of reeds is critical. And if you are out of a diaphragm or you blow through it, stretch it out, and that was the only one you have, for our style of hunting, you're dead in the water. So having a backup upon a backup upon a backup, you know, luckily we own a company that produces those. And so we have a ton of them. But I mean, I carry on my person while if we leave the truck, I've got no less than six diaphragms, the same one that I like to blow. And
that being said, all season you blew how many?
Two.
two, and we bugle like 200 and some odd times a day. And he went through two for the whole season. So that's just being prepared, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, but just to add in, and then, I mean, I think that's the easy part of it. Another tool that I literally lived by is the Onyx Hunt app on my phone. Yeah. I was on that thing all the time, just kind of checking terrain, figuring out.
It saves you steps.
Yeah, it does. You know, trying to navigate through, especially when you're in that heavy timber country, you don't, you know, you can't necessarily get a good vantage of where you are and what's going on. So I was just kind of constantly living on that map. And then also it kind of helps as you learn elk habits, kind of understanding, okay, well, they're going to be on this good chance, this bench down here in the north face. That was where that bull was headed. Okay, he's, you know, and check the map. Most likely that's where they're at, and you can help navigate there based on the wind and everything else. So,
we said about 10 different things,
that's even better yet.
One more to add to all that is boots, man. If your feet are hurting, done. Yeah. You've got to be comfortable. That kind of goes back into my comfortability thing is you've got to be comfortable out there or else it's going to be miserable.
You can look really cool, but if your feet kill you,
you're done.
Yeah. And you guys are what, rocking the crispy boots? Is that what you've been using?
Yeah. We all use a different pair actually, but man, they've been great. They've been great for us.
Cool. Yeah, I got a pair for whitetail hunting, the Wild Rock GTX, the Gore-Tex one. So
yeah,
I've been using those because like where I hunt is different than most places. I mean, I'm hiking a couple miles in and I'm setting up the stand as I'm going, so I don't wear rubber boots. And those boots have been awesome for me. And I haven't used any crispies for elk hunting yet, but they fit my feet really well. And I've tried a lot of different boots out and not all of them fit. And, you know, maybe those won't fit for somebody, but they worked for me. And I was really impressed. It's been just about a year that I've started using those. I bought them last year, right after it was like in the wintertime I bought them, and just a light insulation, and that they've worked really well for the applications that I use them in.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I will say my personal experience, I've had the most foot issues out of all of us.
Yeah.
And every pair of crispy boots that I have worn, I've got Laponias, Summits, Wild Rocks. I have a pair of Thors that I haven't tried out yet. Every boot that I've worn has been great. I've got some of the nastiest heel blisters of anybody. Like if you ever saw that Lathrop and Sons ad where someone had bloody heels, I've done that in several other pairs of boots and have not had that experience in crispy. So.
Gotcha. Well, that's good. Good to hear. Like I said, I think I'm going to try them out. I've wore Loas for the last 3 years and great boots. They've worked out well for me, but they're pretty wore out at this point. So I'm looking at changing up a little bit, and the Summits and a couple of the other ones there have had my interest. But the thing is, I don't know what it is, but I've gotten used to a stiffer boot and I kind of like that. I don't know if I could go to like a really flexible boot for elk hunting at least, but again, that's just because I haven't tried it though either. So
copy. Yeah, I've been the same way. I like stiff boots too. I like a high top boots too, but this year I did a lower top and it seemed to work out for me. But I was just kind of like you as far as I hadn't really done that, so it worked out. It wasn't too bad.
Yeah. And you know, I'm used to, like, I grew up wearing like the, you know, the Iron Setter elk trackers and those, you know, tight boots all the time, and so I was always just used to a high top, and my lows are a little bit of a more of a mid, but still they're stiff, and I seem to like a stiffer boot, a little heavier, but they I don't have any issues with my feet, so that's really good. Yeah, but anyways, do you guys have anything else that you want to add or leave the listeners with from a perspective of, you know, coming from the east heading west, or just basically, you know, adventure hunting as a whole?
I think our only thing is nowadays, back, say, let's go even 15 years back, and it seems not like a long time to me actually, but it's a while back, and it would be super, as it still is, it'd be super intimidating to, you know, without the internet, without all the mappings that we have these days and everything, but with all the technology that we have and all the advice and the know-how now, man, guys, there's nothing holding you back from your dream of coming out west and doing it. Just the only thing holding you back is you. And get out there and say, okay, I'm going to save $100 a month. That's what it is. I got to buy the tag. That's what you're going to use. And I got to buy the gas money. That's all you need. And come out and have an adventure, because you're going to be living off your back. Not like you're going to be in a hotel. You're not spending money on any extra food. You'd be eating at home anyway. So you're going to be spending the same amount of money. It's just gas money and a tag in your pocket. And go out and just have a blast and learn things like we have. It's a huge blessing what we get to do. So that would be my only thing.
Cool. What about you, Cody?
No, exactly that. I think the biggest thing in life for people is fear of failure. And I think the biggest failure is not going. So whatever you have put up this artificial barrier, why you can't do it, it's just an excuse. And break down that excuse and just go do it. And you will learn a lot. You'll have a blast. And I guarantee you'll go back and do it again.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks, guys. Can you give me and the listeners some places that we can find, you know, some more stuff from Born and Raised and what you guys are doing?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much anywhere there's digital media, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, Born and Raised Outdoors. You can find us on our website, bornandraisedoutdoors.com. We've got a podcast on iTunes called The Born and Raised Audio Experience. Well, anywhere a podcast is, I guess. So you can look that up. And yeah, we share content on a regular basis, basically on our YouTube channel 3 to 4 times a week. We've got a couple projects that you look up Land of the Free on YouTube, and you'll find us elk hunting all over the West, archery elk hunting. So.
Yeah.
And doing some blacktail stuff and lots of other stuff too. We're doing the goose hunting right now. We're kind of expanding our horizons. How about that? And stepping outside our box right now, trying to do some other things and to I don't know, see one of these days we're going to get over there in them whitetail woods. One of these days.
Yeah, we're talking about that West meets East, and we're going to kind of reverse the tables on ourselves. We've talked about, anyone can go out and do this out West, and we're going to try to figure out how to do that out East.
Absolutely.
To figure out the whitetail side.
Well, you guys have a resource here if you ever need anything. If you want to hunt mountain whitetails in the Appalachian region here, feel free to get a hold of me. It's a good time. Like I said, right here in Pennsylvania, we have 2 million acres of public land, and it can be a lot of fun. I've taken a lot of the perspective I've gotten out West and applied it to my whitetail hunting, and you can, and as I always say in the podcast and kind of the slogan is, you know, you can kind of find adventure wherever you want it
and just totally
how you perceive it, I guess.
Totally. No, that's great. I like that.
So, all right, guys, well, thanks for coming on, and hopefully we'll be talking to you soon.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's very humbling. Thank you, man.
Appreciate it.
All right. See you guys.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit eastmeetswesthunt.com, Facebook at East Meets West Outdoors, and Instagram at East Meets West Hunt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please review and subscribe, and we'll catch you next time.